Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Kate Goss, who is a serial innovator of research and ideas, and has successfully commercialized them from idea through to exit. We're going to debrief her past experience and learn what will work in the future. Kate, welcome.
Thank you so much, John. Really good to be here.
So, Kate, today we're going to talk about how medium business founders and CEOs can commercialize their research and innovation to dramatically improve, diversify, and future-proof their businesses. But first, tell me a bit about your innovation and commercialization journey. How did you first get involved in this, and how did that journey evolve?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a higgledy-piggledy career. So at school, I was a STEM girl. Loved science, loved maths, terribly geeky, loved New Scientist and all of that. But I decided that I'd go into finance and actually started working as a stockbroker. So I ended up in that space, working in the North American markets. And I found it fascinating, and I had amazing colleagues and work and everything. And then rug was pulled out from underneath me, and we went through a restructure, and I had to reinvent myself. So I think there's a few people going through that at the moment. And at that point, I had an opportunity to move into IT. And so it was late 90s. And at that point, everything was sort of Y2K, GST, everything was being written. There was a lot of very old archaic systems, and it was all the browser-based technology was starting to come. And at that point, as I say, I had this amazing background in the finance and selling trades. They were all manually done. And so at that point, everything from banking and in particular share trading was being done and digitized. So we were actually moving from literally waving, you know, buy, sell, sell, and the share certificates of actually how we now see it today, where you click buy, sell through online trading.
Mm.
And so even though I guess I was sort of very tech focused, I also understood the finance and the processes. So I found myself suddenly in the tech space and actually building a lot of these products. So a lot of the banks and stockbroking firms, but also anything high transactional. So browser based had to be, you know, a mission critical, it couldn't fall over, you had to have failover. And so how were we going to start to build all these new products and take them to market? Amazing. And so that really started my journey in technology. Fast forward from there, I've done 4 startups and 4 exits myself, built products, built services companies, building products, and a lot of partnerships and a lot of business partners along the way. So it's been an amazing journey. It's taken me overseas to London, back to Australia, and has seen me through raising a family, which has been great too.
Sounds like an absolutely fantastic career and exciting enough to keep you stimulated and engaged.
Yeah, never a dull moment. There's always, I like new and I like solving problems. And
absolutely.
Better, so that's great.
So research and innovation commercialization can mean a lot of things to different people, from publishing and licensing to spin-offs and joint ventures or pilot collaborations to full product builds and so on. Today, I want to focus on getting research and innovation to first paying customer in 12 months. Well, where do we start, and what are the principles we need to put in place?
Yeah, it's tough. It's really tough. And I must admit, I think maybe I enjoy rolling up my sleeves and solving for that problem. But you are absolutely right. To go from an idea on a piece of paper to actually getting into a paying customer, it is agonizing at times as to how to transfer between one and the other. Probably for me, one of the things is that you've got to be really clear what's the problem that you're trying to solve. Mm. And that goes across any of what you just mentioned. So there is either something you're trying to solve or cure or develop or improve or streamline. So just got to be really clear what that is. And then in the process of that, because you're trying to work within a short time frame, you've got to be really clear on your MVP is. So what are the critical things that you need to prove that you can actually tick that box? Because there's going to be things that you can obviously build on, and as you start to develop, there'll be a product roadmap. So I think people can sometimes get a bit bogged down on all the million features they want to build out. Yeah. But you've got to be really clear as to what that actual MVP needs to be. And probably a little comment around that one is often where you start can change a little bit. So I think it's really important that sometimes it's not your first idea, it's the iteration a little bit down is actually the real cracker. And I think that probably goes more to, I'm a big believer of getting early customers on board to help collaborate. I think there can be a tendency where people are try to work too long to get it elegant and perfect.
Yeah, I call that polishing the turd.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the reality is, unless you can actually break ground with a customer, you won't actually know what they really value.
Absolutely. And I think I find customers often really, and business partners, so it's probably quite broad, is that often people that genuinely want to innovate and collaborate, they actually really want to help. And I think to sort of put blinkers on and not to take people on the journey, I think is very short-sighted. So I do believe that it's actually really important. And you can get some of your best insights just having a random, you know, the old water cooler conversation kind of. So yeah, so I do believe that is and that's really key. If you want to hit that target within first 12 months, the good thing is that one of the hardest things is then how do you figure out how you price it and what's the value added and what is the impact? Because depending on the innovation or research, sometimes they're wanting to create the impact and that's the measurement. Some people are wanting to create a dollar value. And so they're two very different approaches depending on what you're trying to achieve. And I think, I find those early customers will help you validate that. They will be able to give you the feedback whether you are on track to achieve that impact or to achieve what the price point and the commercialization piece needs to be.
Absolutely. So why don't you walk me through an example to help me understand this?
Sure. So the last 12 months, I've been a little bit off the radar. I'm working with, in particular, around AI. And goodness, who isn't at the moment? I think everyone's throwing that out. So I'll probably eat what I just said. So what was the problem we were trying to solve? And so what was the problem we were trying to solve was that as people go and rush off and try and embrace and use these tools, at some point, you still need to have the right processes and governance and gateways and manage risk around who's using it, how are they using it, making sure that you're not having leakage of your IP, your innovation, your knowledge, your customer database, client, patient data, all these sorts of things. So in the last 12 months, I've been working very heavily on an AI product called Nomio, and it's about how we can develop an enterprise way in which you can engage with this, but can give you all your insights, can manage a still full control. Who can do what, permissions, security, through to being air-gapped. So if it's very, very sensitive financial data or patient data. And so that's been a huge mindset because obviously it's a growing, to be quite frank, AI is exhausting. I have had so many conversations. It's like you wait 3 days and the next release of something's come out. Yeah. It is an exciting space that's rapidly evolving. We've been very fortunate with that is that we have built an MVP, and with that we were able to get an early customer very, very early in the piece, and they were able to help co-create, and we were able to bring in a quite a large global partner into that as well, which we will now be able to co-create the go-to-market for partnerships and delivery globally. So I think that's after that 12 months is then what you need to make sure you're setting that up in there. And you know what? The baby's ugly the very first time. So I thought about the baby, and it's a challenge. It's something that I've seen time and time again in my career. There's a lot of reticence around making sure it's perfect before you start to put it in the hands of. And what I find is that there's obviously usually quite a bit of angst around the engineers that are wanting it to be a certain level because they feel they're going to be criticized if it's not perfect. And then you've got the commercial and the users that are desperate and wanted it yesterday. And in amongst all of that, you've got this rapidly moving innovation space that if you don't get there in time, you miss the mark and you will miss the market. But if you release too early and it breaks, you lose confidence. So it's difficult and you've got to navigate those gates really carefully.
Yeah. And so with Nomio, what were the top three challenges in getting them to first funding? I suspect it's more than just finding someone with passion and deep pockets.
Yeah, so with Nomio, we have been self-funded, so we have bootstrapped. I have in my startups, I have done quite a bit of bootstrapping. To be honest, I feel that it's worked better for getting product market fit much sooner. In addition, have done funding for some projects, but I maybe just focus on Nomio. Some of the challenges was that actually, where do you find the price point? And especially with AI, there is a lot of challenges around, and agentic AI is going to be even tougher.
Yeah.
The traditional SaaS model, and John, I could talk about this all day because I'm up to my eyeballs in working on this, is that the traditional SaaS model has the concept of a seat. But what if that seat is not a person, it's an agent?
Yes.
And one agent can do one task and another agent might do 1,000 tasks. And you can have agents sitting on agents and agents managing agents. And so how you price for that effectively to make yourself scalable and to ensure that you're not going to have cost blowouts as you go to market, there is a lot of challenges. We're starting.
Which brings in trust as an issue too, because what if it goes feral?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And that's from the customers that I've been working with, that's actually something that they are deeply worried about is they have seen, you know, in the last 20, 30 years where you can get vendor lock-in. And then all of a sudden, the cost to move off that vendor to another vendor, it's eye-watering.
Yes.
And so there are a lot of customers, they're trying desperately, and how do we use these tools without vendor lock-in? Because they don't want to make the same mistakes they made 10, 20 years ago. They actually want to be smarter. And there is an arms race going on between all of these AI amazing tools. And they're all solving for different things. And they probably won't survive in the big mergers and acquisitions. And I think that's making it really challenging for customers as to figure out what they are going to depend their business on. How do they control the costs and have flexibility? If the costs get too high, how can they move between different platforms and providers?
Yeah. Well, what do you see as being some of the other challenges in getting to that first funding?
I think, and I think many people have seen this, there is have been a very excited rush around proof of concepts, especially embracing this new technology. And you have, you know, tech teams and they build this amazing proof of concept, but then so what next? How does that then integrate into the enterprise? How do we put that into single sign-on? How do we make it all the risk and the risk profiles and things like that? So part of, I think, the challenge around with the failure, there's so many failures of those. Or is it failures? Or is it that they are exploring and learning? I think there's also an element of, as people are starting to try and innovate, they've got to try and play with it to then figure out what's possible and where the boundaries are. And sometimes they find the boundary and they go, yep, that's not suitable for our business, to not going to suit their risk profile. But on the flip side is that what's the value that's being created internally within the organization? Is it truly going to enable them to scale? What's the proof of concept going to do? And then how do you convert that into something that's actually going to live and breathe and create impact in the business?
Yeah. And so once we've got something that's living and breathing, even as an MVP, what are the next set of major funding and commercialization milestones, and how do you navigate them? How are you going to do that with Nomio?
So I think one of the things, and I start with Nomio, but I do believe there's a storm brewing around IP, and I certainly not going to step into, you know, that's probably going to eventually end up in the courts at some point, I suspect. But one of the things, and a huge challenge that is starting to happen, is people are rapidly building products, tools, ideas, even your website, even your go-to-market communications, everything. And they are embracing these tools, which are fantastic. But there is a lot of concerns around traditionally what is actually your IP? Did you actually create it? How are you going to reference it? And if all of it was built from the intelligence that's been absorbed from the trained models, et cetera, then exactly who owns what? And I think that is going to cause a bit of a firestorm, I suspect. As I understand, there was quite a large bank, and one of their developers accidentally put a whole bunch of their code, and it ended up becoming one of the training models. And there's huge repercussions that come off that. And I guess that's been a real indication of where we started with the work with Nomio. In particular, was that we need to make sure that we can protect that. How can enterprises, but it's even from small business, because small business has IP, medium business has IP, everyone has IP. How can we make sure that we are protecting them while they embrace the technology?
Yeah, yeah. And large organisations, hopefully sophisticated, governance aware, sophisticated at risk identification, management and mitigation. So that puts them in a good place. In the small and the medium business arena, it's often less well informed, less well governed, and frankly, perhaps often a little bit more cavalier. And so, you know, there may not be the thinking that takes them through that process of how do we control our IP? How do we control our customers' data and privacy? And how much of the IP that we're creating is actually ours as opposed to somebody else's? Uh-huh. So, yeah, I think there's one hell of a storm brewing on that Mark, you know, 2 years ago, we were all worried about the Medibank private data breach and the Optus data breach. That's nothing compared to thousands upon thousands of small business data breaches where they might actually inadvertently share their customer data or their supplier data or their financials because they're trying to figure out, you know, how to use this cool AI stuff and not realize that they're exposing themselves and others.
Yeah, absolutely. And what I'm seeing is, and it's wonderful that people are embracing the technology, but you've got workers that are at work and they're loading even small to enterprise business into, you know, their ChatGPT or their Claude, but it means they can then go home and extract that. There's no protection layer from them.
Yeah.
Now, we want people to embrace all these things, because it's amazing, but we need to be able to make sure that there is a structure in which that can be done.
Yeah.
And I think, that's going to be really interesting. One of the other things, just as a slide step, and I know we go down the rabbit hole a few times, John, but one of the other observations that I'm also seeing is the rapid ability to innovate is already a huge disruptor, where you've got small to medium enterprises that can actually rapidly build and scale and deploy. And at the same time, I am witnessing very large enterprises going through a lot of redundancies and restructures. And it's going to be very interesting to see this convergence of can larger organizations downsize or change their culture to be more nimble fast enough to compete with the speed that people can actually build enterprise scalable systems out of small to medium enterprise that could compete directly with them. And there are a number of sectors that I've been working with that are absolutely targeting for disruption. There are some very big, old sectors that have been there for a long time. And I actually think it's fantastic. I think it's about time that some cages were rattled anyway. But I do think we're going to have some very interesting stories in the next few years of huge opportunities for disruption.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, drawing us back to the middle market and thinking about those funding and commercialization milestones, how do we navigate them and what are they?
Yeah, so I think the first one is get your first paying customer. That's exciting. Just literally the first one that will say yes.
Yeah.
I'd always joked, and as long as it's not your mum, your dad, your brother, your sister, your aunt, you know, it's like that's the first real person that actually truly validated and chose you, I think is that's an exciting milestone. The next one is really when you start to be able to get nudged to be able to get your annual recurring revenue up to a point where you are break even. And typically that's not going to happen in the first 12 months, very, very rare. And I think that's really the next big gateway. But there's lots of funding models that you can
switch
from that. You know, there's different ways.
Talk more about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So especially with research and innovation, so there are a lot of government grants. And so there's often ways where you can collaborate. There's also the universities and research institutions. So a lot of them are actually starting to co-collaborate. So they will go after a research grant together. And in speaking with a lot of professors, they find that they get a lot more success if their research grant, if they are partnering with a commercialization partner that can actually help them. And so there's like technology readiness levels, but there's really those commercial readiness levels. And so it is absolutely important that research and universities can usually take it to a certain point. But then there's this pivot point where it actually starts to be able to be the IP, the legals, the terms and conditions, and then the go-to-market strategy and all those sorts of things. So there's huge funding and opportunities around that as well.
Yeah.
There's your traditional VC. And obviously that's it's harder in Australia. So there's some great models. There's some debt funding models based on your revenue cash flow, which is fantastic. I think compared to the US, we are probably doing more poorly, I would say. Having seen a lot of accelerators and VCs, I think there's sometimes, and I have observed, where like you can get sort of people in the very young 20s that are straight out of uni sort of starting to critique whether you fit through the gates of the VC. And I've many founders find that really difficult because, you know, the founders have got the 3 a.m. chest pains and they're trying to create something really special. And they end up having to go through a lot of hoops just to access that funding. So I think there's a lot of challenge with the VC as well. And then you've got seed capital is the other one. And I think seed capital can also be a challenge because I think a lot of founders, as they're looking to have growth aspirations and they're wanting to fund that growth sort of after and beyond. The challenge you have as a founder, and it's the good old founder's dilemma, the minute you take assent from one person that's not you, you have obligations and yes. It is with your company. And you need to be very careful about how you spend the company's money and all those sorts of things. So I have seen a number of times where the founders get a bit confused, where they forget the actual funding. Actually, they're no longer the primary owner of the business. And that can cause a lot of challenges internally within the business when actually you really need to be focused on just growing the business. Yeah. As well. So look, I wouldn't say any of them are better than the other. I guess I have a personal preference for bootstrapping. It means that you can actually work with the people that are wanting to love and walk and feed the puppy. You know what I mean? Like these are the customers, the business partners. It's validating. You're getting absolute insights, feedback. But definitely collaborating and go to market with any of those others, but it's got to be suitable for the innovation or the research that you're trying to commercialize.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, with my limited experience with those on the VC path or on the capital raising path, you know, I often find two things. One, they don't understand the impact of dilution and A, the change and the increase in their responsibilities to the other shareholders. The second thing I get I've seen a number of times is they don't understand the impact of how much dilution, how early, they can be 10, 15 years down the track and find out that, you know, they're realistically, they've got 2-4% of something that's worth something, but it's not really worth anywhere near what it should have been for them at their 2-5%. And that can be quite a shock and a heartbreak. And the third thing that I see, which is sort of slightly related but also different, is that they can get on the series path whereby they're basically going almost from a series of one capital raise to the next capital raise to the next capital raise to the next capital raise. And that's funding really actually their research and innovation, not necessarily scaling the business.
Correct.
And it's almost as if they're actually on research grant funds where, you know, the first third of the grant is actually spent on doing the work, a third is spent on reporting it, and a third is spent on trying to find the next grant. And, you know, so I've often seen founders in that capital raise cycle whereby most of their effort is actually on the next capital raise as opposed to the focus of actually driving the business. And I think that can be a trap that they can fall into.
Well, absolutely. And the impact of going after funding, it often will take the CEO out of the headspace out of the business.
Yeah. At least 3 days a week. Yeah.
Oh, at least. And if they're trying to expand overseas, it takes them completely offshore and different time zone. And it has impact internally, making sure that you've got safe hands to keep the business turning over when they're off doing that. I think that can in turn have impact on their customer growth and revenue you're sort of getting this, do you fundraise, do you grow? And I think there's a lot of challenges around that. I think having a very strong COO is absolutely critical on that path if you're going to do that, because you need safe hands. Absolutely. It's very, very challenging. And you are right that they can get a bit almost, it becomes an addiction to hit the next series, the next series, the next series. And whereas at least with funding rounds from a research funding or a grant, you're not getting the dilution impact, but you are getting cash injection. And I think, you know, and just on that, you know, measuring runway and having absolute critical eyes on that is so important, because it can, if the runway gets short, it can actually make it a really tough place to work for all the employees. And if you are a place that's trying to create innovation and creative thinking, when you start to bring that pressure cooker, it can make it really hard to innovate when they're working in an environment that's, you know, they don't know if they're going to get paid in 2 months, you know, and that happens a lot of startups and scale-ups. So, it's certainly a exciting place to be. It's not the faint-hearted, I'll give you that, John. So, yeah.
No, it's not. Yeah. But not for the faint-hearted. But I guess, okay, so when we've addressed the funding issues, and that's no insignificant task, what then become the sort of the key issues around customer and supply chain issues, around licensing and acceptance issues, and how do we resolve those? How are you going about that, say, for something like Shinomio?
Yeah, so Nomeo, I guess it's a little easier because we own the IP. So I think that's a little bit easier. Where it's a little bit more complex, I mentioned earlier about research institutions and when they're trying to innovate and they're trying to, and amazing innovations have come out of university. So, and often they're co-creating. So you've got, you know, two, three, four, five, there could be huge numbers of universities collaborating on a piece of IP. Where I have found is they often get very excited around developing the product, but control over IP source code, it's really, no one likes doing it. It often gets forgotten about.
Yeah.
I think understanding very clearly who's going to own it, who's going to love it at the other end is absolutely critical, especially when you're looking at research innovation, because it can be the best impact. It can be the best product. But unless it's actually clearly defined where that is going to go, it's then going to, and it does, and we have seen it time and time again in Australia, where it goes and sits on a shelf to gather dust, and where Australia has so much amazing innovation. And it's just that when it got to the end of the project and they get to the end of their 3-year funding cycle, there's no real clear place for it to be delivered to. And I think that is absolutely fundamental. So understanding the IP and then understanding where that transitions into how that's going to survive and live and breathe beyond the 3 years of the cycle of funding. So I think that is absolutely critical.
Absolutely. And I guess, you know, going a step further, you know, we're now starting to talk about the longevity of the innovation that's been commercialized. How does that also get hit by things such as sustainability and the ESG space?
Yeah, it's goodness, that's a big space that's happening. I think there's a lot of people who have been working in that space. I'm quite passionate about, from an ecosystem point of view, with sustainability and ESG. So if I just think about the innovation and what's possible and now what's about to be possible with all of this combination of data and AI. At the moment, we're now sitting on 50 years of technology and data and information. We've got huge growth and impact around Internet of Things. So there's like tiny, tiny little ways of tracking, and it could be anything from tracking a cow to tracking soil moisture. There's now collaboration into pulling down the satellite data, for example, and to be able to have a geospatial data. And what's happening is now we are getting this enormous amount of data and information that's coming, for example, off the farm and farm gate, that's going in through the supply chain, through to the truck it was on, through to the meat processing it could be, or it could be grains, but it now for people to gain market access. And I think this is where we're seeing this interesting convergence of a lot of people tend to think vertically with their technology. You know, you're either in financial markets or you're in government sector or things like that. All of that's starting to change to be horizontal connection. And how do we now take from what's happened at farm and farm gate through the supply chain, through the food and fiber processing, through to how do we use that information and access this information for what would be called market access? So how do we then satisfy for ESG the anti-deforestation laws into Europe? So for you to be able to gain access, for Australia's ag and food sector to be able to gain access to all of that, they need to now produce that data in a secure handshake way the whole way.
Yeah.
But that same information has got regulatory pressure happening around the financial markets. So with ESG, that same information needs to now end up into the banks in the balance sheet. There are certain targets around companies over certain turnover need to be able to start to produce this. They need to be able to verify what is their carbon emissions impact. And so where that makes, I guess, really interesting around that technology piece is how do we now connect across this whole ecosystem and how do we create ongoing sustainability for sustainability to make sure that it's a breeze, because we can't have a thing where we put all the pressure on the farmers to just come up with their data and the answer. And then you have sort of the fat cats at one end of the town that's benefiting from all of that. So that is a complex thing of how do we create that to be a sustainable ecosystem to make it easy, shareable, traceable, and all the other illities and mologies, you know. So that's a big piece of work that's happening with lots of people globally.
Yeah. Yeah, huge amount of work going on around that at the moment, and not a simple task. And I guess that then raises a question about, you know, when we look at these things that are happening across industries and also within an industry, How does this impact the way that performance is measured in while we're in innovation mode?
Yeah, I think it's...
You talked about the runway before, sort of the cash runway. Will we survive the next 2 months for so on? But again, you know, there are other performance measures as well we've got to actually keep an eye on.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you've got your, as you say, you've got your typical financial measurements.
Mm.
I think there's going to be, there needs to be measurement also about how you are competing. And especially now, where are you relative to the competitors of the market? In the last 12 months, I have seen some innovations where they just were too slow and they just got overrun. And I think so there are going to have to be some really important KPIs about the importance of delivery and execution.
Yeah.
It's not just about having a clever idea. You've actually got to get it out there.
Yeah.
And I have seen it. And sadly, because actually some of them are really good ideas and I've been, you know, conversing with them and I could just say that they just needed to go faster. And I think they were too worried, to be honest, about making, they'll try and get their baby not to be ugly and they were trying to make it elegant and they were trying to, whereas it is really important to make a series of good decisions.
Yeah.
Rather than the one best decision. And I think that is absolutely critical if we're talking research and innovation. Time is your enemy. So
yeah.
You've got to get it out there. You've got to get it validated and you've got to get in the hands of the users and get people paying for it. And so I think the cadence is really important. The cadence at which you can get that out. And it's the fastest I have ever seen in my career. The speed at which people can build, innovate, and deploy. It's like nothing I've seen in my career.
It's accelerating, isn't it? No-code scenario was great, and it certainly accelerated things. But now with AI augmented low-code, no-code, that's shortening that development time frame exponentially.
Yeah, absolutely. And my husband loves to tinker, and he's got a bunch of screens up and playing a lot with agentic AI, and it's fascinating. I think slight segue is that what I am seeing is this is a huge opportunity for those that have a bit of grey hair and a bit of experience in NAPS. Traditionally, we were probably a bit hamstrung to be able to innovate or build new products, and I think there is an opportunity for those with a bit of grey hair and experience because we know what good looks like, right? When we ask a question and then blindly accept that that's the right answer.
Yeah.
But what I am seeing is that there are a lot of people starting to innovate and build, and they've got this stream of agents going and building amazing products, and they literally just churn away, and they'd be basically in effect orchestrating, and they're telling them what good looks like, and they're able to check and recheck. And I myself, I've used a bunch of products, and what I can turn out in probably 2 hours would be about 2 months of work if I had employees. And the difference is I know exactly what it needs to look like.
Yeah.
And so I do believe that there's actually going to be huge opportunities around how the agents, and to your point, that agentic AI, that's going to be amazing as well.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, if we rolled back 10 or 15 years and refer to things like the Lean Canvas, you know, one of the big issues was how is your idea, your product, your service distinct?
Yes.
Now, distinct is actually the starting point, and then speed is the most crucial part because there'll be plenty of people who have distinct in resolving this issue. Yep. The question is who gets to market first, or who gets to first customer, and then who gets to scale first.
Oh, absolutely. Because there used to be a moat that would prevent people catching up to you because of their development time.
Yeah.
And you know, there's some great tools where, you know, it's amazing. You go and build me a thing that looks like this product, and you can just grab some screenshots, dump it in there, and away it goes. And so speed is going to be absolutely critical. And I would probably say as much as financial KPIs, I think speed has got to be a new KPI. Probably the next piece on that, which I'm starting to see already, is that people are relying very heavily on these tools and things are breaking. I do think there'll also be opportunities where you are going to have a lot of products out there where it's been built so heavily on this, it breaks and there's no one left to know how to code fix it. So
yeah.
I think there will also be business opportunities to rectify when it's gone rogue, when it's gone grok, you know what I mean? And I think that's going to be, yeah, there'll be a time when all these, when things that have been built will start to fall over because it's iterated too much. And I think, but that, anyway, once again, another business opportunity. So,
well, yeah, I mean, certainly over the last sort of 10 years, I've come across a number of innovations and startups where they've been lamenting and talking about, you know, the size of their tech debt with AI and agentic AI. The nature of tech debt is going to change quite significantly from being our capacity to fix as opposed to our capacity to even understand what's been produced. You're right. It's that in itself will create extraordinary opportunities, but also extraordinary opportunities to whittle away the size of the perceived tech debt, which now can actually be relatively easily replicated.
Yes.
It's always relatively easy when I'm talking about somebody else doing it, not me. So,
yeah, just work harder, agents.
Yeah. Get that AI agent to work a bit faster. So,
well, they work 24/7, right? And
yeah.
So they don't ask for holidays. Although I must admit, it was funny. I was using Claude to do something last night, and I actually had my first lover's tiff with Claude. Claude actually told me if I needed to go to bed. And then I said, if you're going to speak to me like that, I'm going to go use ChatGPT, and it apologized to me.
Yeah, well, I've had a colleague email me yesterday morning saying, you know, I was dealing with our favourite AI model and it out and out lied to me. And I said, oh, you mean a hallucinator? He said, no, hallucination where it makes stuff up. Lying is where actually it tells you it's true when it's not.
Yeah.
Yes, we're still in the early days there. Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. I guess when we sort of think about innovation and commercialisation further, you know, and particularly as you mentioned, the financial side of it, do you see this as being a mature and sophisticated sector? I get the impression that there's now a large quantity of funding chasing innovation, but it certainly causes challenges.
Yeah, look, I think I've been fortunate enough to live overseas and to have a great career over there. I have been back in Australia for a number of years. I see that there are still huge opportunities to improve how we research, innovate, commercialise, accelerate. I think it's still a very confusing market. There's a lot of founders that are very tired. For a number of years, I actually consulted to an accelerator, and that was really eye-opening as well as to how many founders, they actually waited too long to get the help.
Yeah.
So they were sort of in there digging the hole deeper. And that was really challenging because you genuinely can help, because when you've got a few war stories and you can connect a few dots, and if you're passionate about innovation and all that sort of stuff, you know, it's sort of, it's easier. But I think, yeah, it's really important that people ask for help, because you don't have being innovating and research, and especially in small enterprise and especially in senior leadership, it's very lonely.
Yeah,
I'm starting to see a huge growth in fractional work in particular. And I think that's also a symptom of the economic times as well. And also, I believe, you know, with a lot of people working from home and not being in the office. And so I think that's going to have a huge impact. But I definitely in Australia, research and innovation, I think there is huge opportunities when you compare how that's done in Europe, is done particularly well. In the US particularly well. There's fantastic funding out of some Singapore in particular. So they have quite different ways in which they safeguard and make sure it transitions through. I think we're a bit wild west at times in Australia. Probably our taxation laws probably are a little bit different to how it's structured in the US, yeah. Which is why I'm more capitalist. But I guess that's also a cultural thing over in the US as well, which is unfortunately why we see a lot of companies leave. They get to a certain size and they need to get funding and they have to go to the traditional Silicon Valley, because they need to be in a culture. If they want to truly scale, they've got to be in those big markets. And that makes it hard in Australia because our market's very small.
Yeah, yeah. And so if I'm looking to commercialise an innovation or research, what does that process look like? What do I need to put in place if we're now looking at that particular issue?
Yeah. So I guess you've got like the critical issues, some critical decisions, hey? Look, first of all, IP, absolutely critical. I think that's just because you, that's one of the first things. If you are ever going to go for funding, they need to know what is it that you're trying to solve and what actually is your IP. And then next piece is that they will want to know that it's got to be scalable. And I think that is absolutely critical. So having someone with experience and expertise of how to put in exceptional scalable operational systems. So whether it's one customer or onboarding 1,000 or 10,000, it's not going to break. And so if you are thinking about going down the path of funding, know what you're trying to solve. Be very clear. Make sure you are able to clearly articulate what your IP is. And make sure that also it's validated. So is anyone using it? You know, if you've got feedback, what's the accessible market as well? I think that's knowing your market data is really important. With having those fundamentals, that's going to start to get you a good stead as you start to go to seek what your funding might be. And having that really clearly articulated is going to support whichever funding model you go, or you actually just keep selling and you might find that you actually don't need funding because you're so blissfully successful. You've got these customers that are delighted to use your product, and that's fantastic too. So yeah.
Customer-funded growth, that's nirvana.
Oh, isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So it helps you sleep at night and no more chest pains at 3 a.m., which is amazing. So yeah, and then I think, you know, that last thing I just always say, ugly baby syndrome, that will kill any innovation. Not being prepared to just get it in market is really important. And that is challenging. It can be the death knell for any funding because you'll have certain expectations around it needs to be delivered by a certain date. And you've got gates that you must go through, especially if you want to go for another funding round. You need to make sure that if you promise what you're going to achieve, you have to deliver that.
Absolutely.
You have to set expectations clearly. And you have to set your goals clearly, because if you're going to go get them to do another turn of the wheel for the next funding round, you've got to make sure you've hit those targets on the way through.
Yeah, well, that's actually all about your credibility on being able to deliver, as opposed to incredibility about how cool the idea is.
Oh, absolutely. You know, at the end of the day, I think business is business. Like, it's like a true, proper corporate governance, business decisions, processes. It's not particularly interesting compared to the technology and that piece, but that true operational backbone of a business is absolutely critical, and it will make or break a company.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then from your experience, when you're looking at startups and innovation organizations, what do you see as being the top three gotchas that typically go wrong that anybody needs to look out for and avoid?
Well, first one, people.
Yeah. Don't you love them?
Yeah.
You got staff, you got customers, you got suppliers. Wouldn't the world be easy?
Colleagues, founders, business partners, all the people is fundamentally challenging. I think that can be, you know, you can fix technical debt, you can fix a lot of things, but culture, attitude, leadership, you know, I think I think that is got to be number one.
Yeah.
And so people is one of the most trickiest thing to solve for and to get right.
Yeah.
I've had some great business partners over my years. I've also seen some where it's a complete fundamental failure, like absolute loss of trust, and it just all falls apart. And it's disappointing because it's fundamental. You can have the best technology, but if you don't have the right attitude, the right people and the right that's bedded down, it will break a company. And I think it's disappointing. So yeah, absolutely people, number one, hands down above anything else. So, and then I think also, look, yeah, clearly funding, because you can have, if you don't have funding, you go hungry and you get compromised decisions. You have lots of other things. So funding, absolutely.
And it means you're going slow too.
And you're going slow. You cannot accelerate. So
yeah.
And then probably the last thing is maybe critical to our actual discussion today is that innovate, as I think any company that's sitting still is going backwards right now.
Yeah.
There is absolutely critical to continue to look at process improvement, streamlining, there's always opportunities for cost minimization around internal processes. There's huge disruption around operational systems, that there's a lot of things that things you would have had to pay a lot for is now becoming far more economical with far more feature rich offerings as well.
Yeah.
Example of CRMs, they've changed enormously. You know, so I think, yeah, lots of changes happening around that. So those operational systems, cost, you know, controlling costs constantly and keeping really lean, I think is really important as well.
Yeah.
Well,
excellent. If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au. Well, I guess final question then, Kate.
Yeah.
If a founder or CEO is looking to start commercializing research and innovation in their organization, what critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
I think some of the best things to do is actually I just go for a walk with a dog, get some headspace.
Yeah.
I think we're in a very crowded, noisy world. We're very overstimulated.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes you need to actually take a step back, get some time in your own head. I absolutely love going for a walk with the dogs or just being in the garden and, just the amazing things, you know, I should do this. Actually, you know what? You should go after that. And I think if there's one thing to do, and you don't have to nail any of it, but actually just be brave and to go, if I was going to, and I would say, what annoys me? You know, it's like some of the best things. It's like, what's annoying me? What can be solved? What's ripe for disruption? But you need time and space and in particular headspace. And I think absolutely give yourself a treat and get your brain just to work and collaborate and think. And that's the starting point. Just start there.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me think about so many things, but yes, taking the time out, be still and allow those mental gymnastics to occur or not. Fantastic. Kate, it's been an absolute delight to catch up with you again. Always enjoy our conversations.
Yeah, thank you so much, John. I really appreciate it. And if you can't tell, I quite like innovation. And I look forward to our next chat.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused and take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualised business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.